Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Tom Gash. Tom is an advisor, researcher and writer on crime policy and government effectiveness, who helps people to think differently about the big challenges facing governments worldwide. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for Government, a visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics, and an expert advisor for the Boston Consulting Group. He's going to talk to us today about his book, Criminal, The Truth About Why People Do Bad Things, which challenges many of the assumptions and entrenched beliefs that are commonly held about crime and criminals. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Thanks very much for speaking to me.
You're welcome. Okay, well, could you begin, Tom, by telling us a bit about your background, maybe what sparked your interest in crime in the first place, and what prompted you to write the book?
I think from your introduction there, it sounded like I have far too many jobs, but I started out doing a relatively mundane job doing management consulting. And I did lots of analysis of how firms were getting on, whether they were making money, how they could make more money. And this wasn't entirely satisfying to me. I think for a long time, really, I knew that I would end up somewhere in the public sector trying to do something about big issues that I cared about in society that were going wrong. And the thing that kicked me into leaving consulting and going into a job in government in the what was then called the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit, working on the crime policy brief that I had, was meeting a woman in a train. And I was sitting there in my suit going back from Surrey and a pharmaceutical company that I'd been working with on this consulting project. And it was actually the last day of the project, so I was sort of exhausted, but reasonably upbeat. But the person I met had even more of a last day experience, because she'd just got out of jail and she cropped up behind me in incredible excitement. And I was sitting in a first class carriage, and she said, So do you reckon it'd be all right if I sit here? Because I've just got out of Bird and I just want to celebrate. And I sort of said, well, that sounds absolutely fine. And then we just started to get into a conversation. And hearing about her life and her experiences made me realise really that what we were currently doing in the criminal justice system was clearly no way to run anything. The experience she'd had was, you know, too long to go into now, but she was not a drug user herself, but been involved in drug dealing, a victim of domestic violence. She had six kids. One of them was in care. But the main thing that shocked me was that then, as now, you basically get your 40-odd quid, £42, on leaving prison. Yeah. And she was going off to no fixed abode, no reasonable prospect of employment, no real transition support. And she was basically had all the best intentions, but when I asked her what she was going to do next, she was going to meet up with one of her old friends and have a drink in Soho. And you could see the sort of cycles repeating themselves very, very easily. And whilst she was such a lovely lady, yeah, she just it was clear that she was going to really struggle to actually adapt and stay out of prison on the other side. And so after that, shortly I started applying for my jobs and ended up in government policy. And then I was even more shocked about how bad sometimes government policy is around crime and criminal justice. And I started to want to understand more about that and more about what we could do to improve matters. And I fundamentally realised that one of the things that was driving all of the political decisions was public opinion. Mm-hmm. And so I had to set myself a really ambitious task of trying to write something that would appeal to a general reader, someone who's interested in social issues, but perhaps, you know, not someone who would automatically pick up an academic book or was studying the subject. I wanted to have something entertaining, lively, and that really challenged people to think differently about crime.
Yeah, well, I was certainly your audience there, Tom, and that's definitely how the book came across to me. So I think you've done a good job there. Well, could you then just for the listeners, give us a rough overview of the book. I know that's a challenge in itself.
It's a huge challenge. The book has some central arguments running through it. The first, I think, is the importance of understanding that a lot of behaviour that's criminal is very impulsive and opportunistic.
Yeah.
It's not very carefully planned. And that leads to all sorts of other points about crime that people often miss. I'm always having conversations about why tougher sentences don't necessarily reduce crime, because you'd think they do, right? You know,
yeah.
Well, if the consequences are worse, why would I do it? But in actual fact, of course, you look at the situations around crime and you suddenly realise that there's so much emotion involved and there's very little planning or forethought involved in so much crime that changing the odds doesn't make much difference. I always like to say, if you think about the typical murder in the UK, it's probably a domestic incident where somebody kills somebody that they, at least in some way, love, and they have got probably an 80 or 90% chance of being caught and convicted, and then the average recommended minimum tariff will be something like 22 years.
Yeah.
So they don't get anything out of it fundamentally already. It's already a terrible decision. So lots of people say, well, let's make this decision even more disastrous and that will stop them doing it. And it's already a really bad decision. So you can't influence people in that way. So it's very important, I think, to understand that the importance of the fact that crime is often opportunistic and emotional. And that actually goes for sometimes acquisitive crime as well as violent crime, so stealing stuff and burglary. Sometimes they are more emotional and more about immediate satisfactions than sometimes we like to imagine. The second argument that I think runs through the book is, I think, probably just the limits of rationality. So it's connected to that. It's the importance of opportunity, but really the limits of rationality in all sorts of domains of crime. The fact that we're just not calculating things carefully. But I think actually there's also a fair amount of lack of rationality in our responses to crime. We respond to it very emotionally, as well as people who commit crime doing so under forces of emotion. But the book itself is broken down into 11 different myths about crime. So really I challenge lots of different smaller arguments about crime that often people buy into. So people argue there's a strong link between immigration and crime rates, and I sort of share the evidence on why that isn't really the case, actually. Similarly, actually, poverty, which when I went into my job at the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit, I always thought, well, poverty clearly causes crime, right? That must be a big driver of this. And then the more you dig into it, more you realise it's not actually material poverty that affects people's likelihood of committing crime so much as it is other types of poverty, sort of, you know, lack of ability to deal with stressful situations, coming under more stress and strain. A lot of, you know, people who end up in our criminal justice system are, you know, have suffered different types of abuse and trauma growing up. Not by no means all, but that's certainly true for them, for many of the most violent and troublesome people in prison. And so you start to realize it's not the money that matters so much. And in some weird ways, sometimes money in a way causes crime, because criminal opportunities are so important. One of the things that, you know, undoubtedly drove the spike in crime that we experienced in the 20th century, in the post-war period, was the rapid increase in the amount of disposable, valuable material goods that there were available for being stolen. So money matters, but it has very odd impacts and often small scale ones. So, you know, I think we overstate the degree to which it's driven by poverty. And you can see that, of course, in when you notice that lots of people who are very poor never get anywhere near breaking the law, and are sort of very, very upright. I say never, I mean not habitually, because one of the things I also like to point out is that 9 in 10 of us probably have broken in the law at some point in time.
Yeah.
I always like people to recognise that fact. It's just a question of how much really we're breaking the law and what types of law breaking we find acceptable or we engage in every now and then.
Sure, yeah. Well, as I said, as I sort of alluded to earlier, I found the book absolutely fascinating, Tom. And That one about poverty, particularly, that my views were challenged there. Now we're obviously constrained by time in this interview to go into too much detail, but it might be interesting to unpack some of the ideas to help listeners get a bit of a feel for the book. So for example, why do you think so few people think that crime is falling? Apparently, you say in the book it's only about one in five.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, worth recapping on the trends in crime. So what's basically happened is, not just in the UK, but in most developed countries, almost all developed countries, in the post-war period, we saw rapid increases in crime until about the early 90s. And then suddenly from the 1990s onwards, crime started really declining quite rapidly. So that crime in the UK is sort of less than half, about half, maybe, it depends on the crime type a little bit, but all crime types have fallen a bit, and most have fallen by about a half. So it's a really fundamental shift in crime in the last 25, 30 years. Yeah. And that's not just a UK trend, it's a global trend. But it's one that people don't notice, because I think what happens is we are most affected by, when we try to think about incidents, we are affected by memory. So we remember an incident of crime recently, or we remember seeing a number of stories recently, because you remember more recent events more vividly. And therefore, you sort of think that your recent experiences of crime have been greater than in the past. And of course, the other thing that's going on, so there's something there that's about psychological biases, behavioural, the way we think. But there's something else, of course, which is that actually there's a lot of misreporting of crime statistics. So I've got some examples in my book of where, you know, almost every type of crime has fallen and one type of crime has risen, and it becomes the headline. You know, so it's something like robbery soars, and you know, you find out that robbery increased by 4% and every other crime fell by a fair amount. And it's that statistic that happens to be chosen and picked out, because there's the famous story in journalism, the famous line is, if it bleeds, it leads. And that means that you get a huge amount of crime reporting in the papers, which makes everyone think that everything's going to hell in a handcart. And then they pick out the statistics that are most frightening, because people are fundamentally drawn to crime, I think. And this is something I talk about in the introduction, but, you know, we are drawn to crime so much, something deeply psychological about it. If you think about what's on television, I mean, it's detective story after detective story after detective story, plus, you know, some wire type shows, all the HBO dramas that I'm a huge fan of. You know, they somehow appeal to us. It's something about this sort of good versus evil view.
Yeah, yeah.
It allows us to explore our own morality, I think, and to sort of explore the boundaries and the extremes of human behavior. But I think in doing so, we also tend to tell stories that reinforce our preconceptions about what crime is and how crime works. And obviously we oversimplify and tell stories that we like rather than want stories that represent the world.
In terms of the news as well, is there perhaps a negativity bias going on? You know, that the idea that we're more prone to there's a saber-toothed tiger in that valley rather than some strawberries in the other. You know, that's been adapted for a big part of our evolutionary history.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm absolutely sure that's true. It's interesting. So about two-thirds of people in the UK think that crime is rising and have done for the last sort of 20 years, even though it's been falling. People are a little bit less pessimistic when you ask them about crime in their area, which is quite interesting, because it suggests that where people have real actual experience to go by, they are slightly less inaccurate in their assessment. Okay. And the other thing that's quite interesting is that if you ask different questions in surveys, like, so if you ask people, how likely do you think it is you will be burgled during the next year, they massively overestimate the likelihood of being burgled or being victim of an assault or whatever on average. But it's interesting that their predictions of how likely they are to be victims actually change as crime changes to a degree. So as crime is falling, their estimate of how likely they are to be victims is falling. It's just it's higher than it should be. So we are influenced by reality a bit, but particularly where we're talking about, when we frame things in terms of local experience or our area. But when it comes to national stuff, we're much more influenced and distorted by the media and the representations, and I think by our own sort of biases and ways of thinking.
Well, there's an example at the moment with the, there's been a recent spate of terrorist attacks, you know, the one just the other day in France, in the church in Rouen. You talk about the availability bias as well, that, that we overestimate the probability of very infrequent events.
Yeah, that's right. And but I mean, with terrorism is a case in point of exactly this, because we've been talking about the massive surge in terrorism for the last 10 years. I don't have the recent statistics, because my impression is that maybe things have changed with ISIS to a degree, but I don't know how much. I mean, it certainly wasn't the case. We were talking about unparalleled levels of terrorism in the mid-2000s and late-2000s, early-2010s. And then you're sitting there and you're thinking, but wait a second, what about during the Troubles? There were the number of casualties on UK soil from terrorist activity is far, far higher than it has been for the last 15, 20 years. Yeah. And even globally, you'll find that incidents have gone down and conflicts reduced for a long period there, when people would still say they were going up. So we have this huge tendency to think about these sort of golden age. Actually, that, there's another thing that reflected in I think, voting around Brexit. Where I think some of the people who were voting Leave were also wanting to go back to a time that they had idealised or romanticised in their heads about when Britain had autonomy and things were all the same, were all much better. But again, you know, in the rose-tinted glasses, things can seem better than they perhaps were, and that's not a comment on the pros and cons of Brexit. It's just to recognise that people do have this tendency to look back nostalgically and be a bit pessimistic about the future.
Okay, can we move on a little bit now then, Tom? Could you tell us a bit about the econometric method, a way of measuring crime and its frequency, and what limitations does it have?
So econometrics is basically a branch of economics, and it's a method. It's a way of understanding what causes what, effectively, or what's related to what. So in crime, what people tend to do is they say, let's have a look at what's happened to crime rates over the last 15, 20 years, and let's see what might have caused that. So you put you get some data on things like GDP, you might get some data on number of people, households in poverty, you might get some data on number of police, prisons, etc. And then you basically write a formula, you run it through some sort of software to do some sort of regression analysis of various degrees of sophistication, and then you get results from your little mathematical model, and it will say which of those factors that you plugged into your little model has the closest relationship to crime. Now, a lot of people hold a lot of sway by these models, and this is the method that Stephen Levitt used in order to say that abortion was responsible for half of the reduction of crime in the US, which is a very, very bold claim. His claim was that that the legalization of abortion under the Roe versus Wade ruling, it led to a massive drop in crime 20 years later. And he did that, but like all econometric models, he had a limited number of variables in there. He actually miscoded some of his models as well, which someone picked up later when they questioned his analysis. But the fundamental point is, it's very hard to capture in these models the real complexity of the world. Partly, you're very constrained by what data is available. So you quickly say, well, what I really want to measure is sort of, you know, how much security there is, how much government security is there. But then you realize you've got data on police numbers, but you haven't thought of including private security. So you didn't include the equal number, frankly, not of you know, private security guards there are versus police officers. And before you know it, you just realize that these models have left out so much of the world and its complexity, and they draw very strong conclusions about what they've proven about the relationship between crime and, you know, whatever factor they happen to think is important. And they get very attached to these models. And so there's a very good quote, actually, from which is that econometricians, like artists, tend to fall in love with their models, which I think is very, very apt. So some people are very attached to these, but the more you look at them, the more you realise that all they are is they give you some indications, some ideas, but they're really very weak as methods of proving a relationship between something and crime. The real way to look at relationships between different social factors and different environmental factors and crime is to set up small-scale experiments or to find natural experiments. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is the time when, very boldly, in the 1970s, a Kansas police chief decided to stop patrolling in significant sections of his of Kansas. And that was a hugely brave thing to do, but what he realized was that the random patrolling that his officers were doing was making absolutely no difference to the crime rates in the area, based on both surveys of residents and police records. So it's a hugely important thing to actually use these experiments to test out whether what we're doing is working, and rather than relying on these mathematical econometric models, which, as I said, I wouldn't say they're completely useless, but sometimes you're really struck by how varied the results are depending on the persuasions of the author, let's put it like that. So one of the things that people look at is, say, how important prison is for reducing crime, and you can plug in various different variables and come up with very different answers. And so one person, a PhD student from Germany, did this absolutely stunning piece of work where they looked at 100 or so studies of whether prison and policing made a big difference to crime rates. And he found that basically, on average, there was a huge spread of what these models had concluded, so that you had as many people saying it made no difference at all as or even made matters worse as you did saying made things better. So it just shows how unreliable the method is. And when you don't understand that and you sort of see it in a newspaper and no one's sort of explained this to you, then it's obviously natural to be impressed. In fact, there's a study that says it's if you see an equation in a paper that you don't understand and you're not mathematically minded, you're more likely to believe the results, even when it's a completely meaningless equation that's not related at all to the subject in question. So we can be a bit dazzled by this stuff if we're not careful.
Okay, in what ways does Walter Mischel's marshmallow test, the test that you did on deferred gratification, provide clues to criminal behaviour?
Yeah, so it's just to recap for listeners, it's a study where basically they're on children, and you basically give a child a marshmallow, and you say, well, if you can wait for X number of minutes, then you can get another marshmallow, or if you want, you can just eat the one marshmallow straight away. So it's basically, will you wait? Will you delay gratification? And Walter Mischel is a Stanford psychologist, and he started doing this, I think, first of all with his kids and then the nursery that they went to, all the nursery kids at Stanford. So there was a nursery at Stanford for the professors and staff, and he started to do these little tests and experiments. And what was really interesting was, first of all, he just noticed that there was a big variation. So some people could wait, some people couldn't. He did lots of varieties of this experiment. But then he started to speak to his kids about how some of the other kids were getting on later as they got older. And he started to notice that the ones who hadn't being able to wait for the second marshmallow were having all sorts of problems, like dropping out of school, less likely to be in sort of stable jobs, good relationships and so forth. And so he then did a much more thorough set of studies, wondering about the long-term consequences of the inability to delay gratification. And he found there were links between, the inability to delay gratification and all sorts of things like substance misuse, likelihood of ending up in prison, committing crime, various different factors. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me because, as I said, you see a lot of crime doesn't seem to be, it's very immediate and impulsive. So it seems to fit to me that would have a strong relationship. And so one of the things I am very interested in is these sort of attempts to try and help people to make better long-term decisions, delay gratification, also manage stressful situations more effectively at school that people are trying to do. Now, you don't want to get too far, you know, you need to make sure those things work and make sure they're valuable for the people involved. But it does seem something that's worth us thinking about.
When you say that, are you talking about things like mindfulness from an early age or critical thinking?
Both of those things, I think. It's just recognising that actually there are some ways of thinking and some ways of dealing with situations that people are faced with daily that are sort of broad life skills that sort of help, not just in school and learning, but they also help, in life and particularly around crime and addiction and other areas.
Sure. Okay. Moving on to another myth. To what degree does crime pay?
This is a good one. So obviously, crime pays for some people, but it often pays for the lucky people, and then it doesn't pay for very long. That's what I'd say. So the basic way most people make money in terms of crime is to do with drugs. So that's where people are making reasonable sums of money if they're involved in drug import, export, mid-level distribution. But people make a lot less money than you might think. There's another famous example study from someone who wrote a book called Gang Leader for a Day, who's called Sudhir Venkatesh, and he's a Harvard sociologist, and he managed to get his hands on the record keeping books of a drug dealer in Chicago, and found out that they basically all the foot soldiers earn less than minimum wage. And that's partly because for most people, crime is not a job. And the idea that crime is a job is completely misleading. It's one of the things that causes all our problems around how we deal with it. Crime is just something that happens alongside or incidentally to life. People find opportunities to make money, sometimes illegally, sometimes legally, and they take them. But I think we overestimate in general the degree to which people are making huge sums of money because, again, the media likes to exaggerate. There's a bit in my book about the way in which the police report how much drugs they've seized and the value of the drugs they've seized. So they'll sort of talk about everything in terms of street value, which is sort of and so they'll seize a cargo of a ship, which has been sold from one person to another person and it's en route. And they'll say, well, we found drugs with a street value of X. And that's sort of one way of doing it. But the other way of doing it is, but it's sort of the equivalent of finding a load of coffee beans and then saying you found it at the value that it was going to be sold at Starbucks, at the retail end of the spectrum. And so you end up with these really inflated estimates, which imply that those people who are doing the transportation are getting all of that money, whereas they wouldn't, of course. They would get a much smaller sum. So, again, we tend to overestimate, and we love the stories. You know, we always like to have the stories about the big criminals, the ones who are making it huge and have, you know, baths in huge quantities of cash and roll around their living rooms and live in massive mansions. And of course, people make money out of crime, but most of the people who are filling up our criminal justice system are not those people. They are people who are living hand-to-mouth existence, may make money but lose it incredibly fast rates for whatever reasons, either addiction or just not being very good with money. And it's certainly not a life that people want to stay in. I mean, one of the things that I've been struck by speaking to people in gangs and people who've got out of being involved in drug dealing and other areas is just how stressful the lifestyle can be. That it's not actually a very desirable environment to be in. It's sort of, people find it quite thrilling and exciting, I think, in their sort of mid-early teens and late teens to be more involved in crime. But as people get older and they develop family ties and all sorts of other things, then it's just an incredible stressful existence because you have to hang out with people who are often, you know, violent, have very poor ability to control their emotions and tempers, unreliable. So it's not always the best environment to work in. And so it's not just that it doesn't pay, it's just that actually being habitually involved in crime is just not a very nice existence. I'm not saying you should feel sorry for people because of that. There are sometimes degrees of choice that people choose it, but it's certainly it's certainly not the place that I would choose to go to make my money.
Sure, and that leads into another myth, that this idea that there are career criminals, the actual percentage of people that remain in crime throughout their lives is actually very small, isn't it? You say you've got 3 or 4%. Most of the people
right.
grow out of it or just get fed up with it.
Yeah, and one of the things that we don't like to admit that I write about is the fact we have this image of children as being these pure little beautiful angels. And when you start to examine what children are actually doing in their toddlers and their very young ages, you suddenly realise that all of the behaviour that you see, the sort of the biting, the kicking, the grabbing, taking everything for yourself, not being able to share, all of that stuff that we obviously naturally accept in kids is stuff that you later classify as criminal.
Yeah.
Of course, for reasons, there's intent in older people and different type of consciousness in a way there isn't in the very young. But what seems to be going on is we've got this idea that people grow into crime and they learn their way into criminal behaviour. But I argue that it's actually rather the opposite. It's that actually most people learn their way out of these sort of unproductive forms of behaviour. They're dealing with conflict through violence, all that sort of stuff. They learn, taking things that aren't yours, not negotiating things, etc. Most people learn their way out of that, but some people don't. Some people carry on. And some people take longer to learn than others. So, you know, some people will sort of not learn their way out of crime until they are in their 30s, 40s, but then will still stop and settle down largely. And then others will, as you say, a tiny proportion will go through life still carrying on committing lots of crime and getting into fair amount of trouble for it. So I think we need to challenge that view that people sort of fall into a life of crime, both because they're not normally falling into it. They're normally continuing behaviours they already had. And then it's also not normally for a life. It's not normally for a lifetime. It does stop eventually. And that's important. It stops eventually without the criminal justice system in most cases. People stop for other reasons, you know, the social pressure, different roles that they're taking on in life, and just the realisation that actually this isn't always a very good idea. It doesn't normally pay off.
Yeah. Okay. Can we have a look at the idea of responsibility now, Tom? You suggest in the book that people tend to be more tolerant, for example, of a criminal having a chemical imbalance rather than abusive parents, say. So why is that? What's going on there?
Yeah, the chapter on sort of genes and brain pattern and behaviour was one of the hardest to investigate. I was delighted the other day when I spoke to a neuroscientist who liked it and enjoyed it and thought it was very, very fair and representative of the latest research in the field. This is my greatest achievement in the book, that I could keep a neuroscientist happy. But what that chapter looks at as well is obviously not just the science about how does biology influence behaviour. It looks at the question of how the legal system and others are starting to relate to these ideas of criminal responsibility related to biology. So as you say, there are a number of people who are presenting brain scans in court, for example, and saying, look at these abnormal brain scans. This offender clearly can't be held responsible for their actions. So there are scientific reasons not to be too taken in by brain scans, which I go into. But there's this, as you say, this huge philosophical question about whether it does make someone more or less culpable if they have some sort of human have some sort of illness effectively, or some sort of medical difference. And I think I came to the view that it's a very tricky area to be going into. And on the one hand, you could say, well, this is great because it encourages a much more humane approach to people who are committing crime, and it starts to understand their difficulties and needs. But on the other hand, you can also look at the same evidence of someone's difference, a biological difference, and you say, well, they're obviously a wrong 'un. We need to lock them up forever or throw away the key, and all that sort of stuff. The conclusion I came to was that I think it's better in the criminal justice system to deal with actions at this stage, rather than looking at any of our assessments of what we think might or may not be wrong with somebody. In most cases, unless we can find some sort of serious medical disorder that needs to be treated, I still think that that's a separate issue from the punishment for the crime to a degree. So I didn't really reach, as you can tell, I wasn't fully certain about my what I thought about all this stuff philosophically, but it struck me there was a lot of funny business going on in terms of the way in which this evidence was being used in court to get basically people using it one way or the other to get what they wanted.
So in terms of then how responsibility should be measured, are you saying that we should focus more on the deed rather than on the person? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the truth is that we have shifted towards more of a risk-based approach, as it's called, to dealing with people who've committed crime. So we used to be much more, well, this is how serious the crime was, this is what you get. Now we're much more saying, you know, in various domains, we're saying, actually, you committed this crime, but you seem well dangerous and well dodgy, so we're going to keep you inside for ages. That was the rationale behind a sentence called the indeterminate sentences for public protection that were implemented in the UK and did they come in 2003, I think.
Okay.
And they ended up putting lots of people who had committed a crime worthy of 2 years, 3 years, 4 years prison term in prison for very, very much longer than that. I think that ethically is not very defensible, mm-hmm. particularly when, you know, once you know how these assessments are made, you know that they're not that reliable. And so it becomes very, very ethically difficult, I think, to make the decisions based on someone's risk. But obviously, at the same time, if you know that someone is at the very, very extreme end of that risk, and you know that they are basically definitely going to do something again, you know, where you're really, really confident that they have severe mental health pathologies that mean they are going to reoffend, and that's for certain, then of course the government can't be letting people out on the street in those circumstances, and that's where we've for a long time had some exceptional powers to retain people under detention, but normally with a judicial decision to support it. So I think it's just about where that boundary and that line is drawn. So I'm much more in favour of punishment for the crime than I am for judgment on risk at the moment. But I still, even I allow a little bit of scope to say that some people are so dangerous that they obviously aren't safe to be operating in society and in communities.
One thing that you didn't go into detail, particularly in the book, but I'd just quite like to ask you about this, that I'm thinking about penal systems where there's a focus more on rehabilitation, for example, in Scandinavian countries, rather than the more arguably punitive societies. You could argue that the UK and the US, there seems to be, say, for example, in Scandinavia, a lot less reoffending when responsibility when you go to prison is actually cultivated. I mean, admittedly, you can only work within the sort of confines of the particular culture. But what's your personal opinion on that sort of dichotomy there?
Well, one of the problems is that every country measures its reoffending rates in a different way.
Okay.
And reoffending rates are a sort of a product of a lot of things. So one of the real problems there is we don't actually know what the difference is. Are in reoffending rates across these geographies,
right?
Then we're not quite sure why there are differences. So one of the reasons I don't talk about it so much is because of that, because we can't really be certain what's going on. I think in the Scandinavian countries, they obviously do have a slightly different approach, which, as you say, reflects culture and society more generally. But I wouldn't completely take it for granted as something that will remain the case. So I certainly know Scandinavian politics is changing a lot as a result of immigration, and there is a sort of rise of a bit of more sort of far right anti-immigrant sentiment, and more frequent connections are being made in the press between immigration and crime.
Yeah.
And you know that in a sense what other quite insular countries have been opened up, and that's had sort of social consequences that can create the sorts of insecurity that create for a more punitive climate. So that stuff can change, I would say. In terms of the regimes and what works, I mean, it certainly seems that they get away with, in places like Norway, in particular, they get away with much more liberal ways of treating prisoners. The prison conditions are much more favourable and much better, and it is much more emphasis, as you say, on prisoners taking responsibility both for their management of their lives in prison and of their own rehabilitation. So, you know, that does seem a difference. But of course, you've got slightly different people sometimes going in, and different conditions, different amounts of money. So it's difficult for us to be certain about which regimes are better. But obviously, lots of people are drawn to those regimes as more humane.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Right, there are three cases at the end of the book, Tom, which I think illustrate the shortcomings of our standard responses really well. Could you touch on them briefly and the significance of what they tell us?
Yeah. So we talk about the need for tough sentences, or the need for generally, you know, huge societal reform that eliminates inequality to reduce crime. And I like to focus on smaller scale examples. And so one of the ones I use is I look at car crime, which has fallen by to about a sixth of its peak levels in the past decade or so in the UK. Massive fundamental change. The way this was achieved was fundamentally by improving car security, but the story behind that is really interesting, because the car companies weren't doing that by themselves, because until the sort of 1990s, there was very much a view in the car industry that every car stolen was one more sale, you know, particularly when cars were being stolen and burnt out and so forth. And insurance pays, and consumers didn't really care so much about it. So one of the things that government did there that was very interesting, and I think also happened as a result of consumer pressure, was people started to publish rankings of how easy cars were to steal. Then the car industry started to think, oh, actually, maybe we do need to think about safe, you know, how easy cars are to get into. And, you know, used to literally be able to stick, you know, you still can with some brands, actually, I'm not going to tell you which, but you can use the same security on some cars. You use the same car to open a Ford Cortina would open almost every other Ford Cortina. So it's that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So they got rid of all those sort of loopholes over a period of time and introduced immobilizers, and that had a big impact on rates of car crime. And importantly, it didn't seem to divert to other types of vehicle theft either. Another example I talk about is metal theft, where there what we did was got rid of cash payments for metal theft, because what was really going on actually was that a number of people in the metal industry were quite dodgy, and they knew that, you know, they knew they were buying stolen scrap, but they could take cash for it, and then they would not, they would say, well, we haven't seen this, but, you know, we don't know who it was. Or actually, on the other hand, it might be just gullible dealers who were just getting taken in by people who were taking in their stolen scrap and getting some cash for it. They'd shifted to a pure electronic payment only basis. So everyone had to provide identity document and credit information in order to receive the payment for their metal. And it had a really big impact, not just here where we did it, but also in some of the US states that tried this. And we tightened up the regulatory environment completely around the industry. And of course, people therefore found it much harder to get rid of scrap. And it just takes a little bit of tension or friction or difficulty sometimes for people just not to bother. You know, just not to bother with the crime, because a lot of it's just walking down the road, seeing the opportunity to do something and knowing that you can get rid of it somewhere easily. That's the thing that tips someone into doing crime or not doing it. And then you might even be the case that you know that you can get rid of scrap, and then while you're in a premises you might commit another crime as well. So it can have a multiplier effect too. And the third example I look at is around alcohol-related violence. And alcohol-related violence to me is really interesting, because I remember growing up, I'd had friends who would get into a fight 1 week, but they wouldn't get into a fight the next week. And that immediately, for me, has always made me realise that violence around alcohol is circumstantial, or rather it depends on what's been going on that night.
Yeah.
And so the experiment I talk about a lot in this book, I mean, talk about Cardiff and various other places as well, but there's a good example from an experiment in Australia in a place called Surfers Paradise, which is sort of like a sunny Blackpool. And so debatable whether it's a paradise or not, but, you know, I don't know who I mean. So the analogy may be insulting two different populations. But they basically tried out loads of different measures to reduce violence that were all about making spaces and environments more pleasant. So it wasn't about deterrence at all. It was about making the environment more encouraging, more mixed groups. They did lots of things to reduce alcohol consumption, like smaller glasses, made soft drinks available, which sometimes they aren't. Some venues were increasingly interested in food. But the other thing they did was they did much more on door security to prevent trouble from escalating. Not just eliminating clientele, but much more management of conflict before it escalated, and much more creating an environment that was warm. And I think that's a change. I think we've seen a bit actually across a number of cities, towns in the UK as well, where there's a slight shift from that old school bouncer who basically used to start all the fights to people who actually are trying to help people to have a good night when they're out and reduce the conflict and the violence.
Okay. Right, the middle way, as we understand it in our society, Tom, is this: the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience, so we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today? For example, you say at one point in the book, we must suspend our outrage to understand crime as a risk that can be managed, as well as a wrong to be condemned. Is that trying to sort of find a middle way?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think when I read the description of what the middle way do and the way of thinking, I thought that I was very much one of your camp. Because I think my goal for the book varies depending on who's reading it. So if someone is very open-minded, my goal is to try and actually influence their thinking and influence their views to a degree. But also to always keep their minds open that what I'm sharing in the book is the latest evidence and it's my interpretation of that evidence. And, you know, always to keep an open, critical mind, because my style is fundamentally quite sceptical. But at the same time, for people who have very fixed minds and fixed views, this was an important thing to me, was to try and write in a way that could bring people to question their own views. And even if you get people into a state where their minds are more open, I think that does lead to much better thinking and much better dialogue and discussion. I think we've really suffered a lot from, and we still are suffering in the UK, from the inability of people to actually have conversations.
Yeah.
People dividing into, and this is partly the dynamics that you get on the internet and social media, where people divide into their camps and can't find alternative viewpoints. They are speaking to the people who speak like them, and then if they're speaking to someone else, it's very hostile types of engagement, which depersonalized in an internet world allow you to be very black and white. The other thing that happens is extreme views get amplified, they get more hits, they get more arguments. I just put a piece up on Guardian Opinion on drugs legalization, where my view is sort of broadly, you know, we should be liberalizing to a degree, but, you know, let's be considered and evidence-based and careful about it. But if what I notice is that the articles that do really well on any sort of internet platform are the ones that are the most controversial, semi-offensive, because they spark lots of comments, yeah. Which, and then there is warring faction comments, and then the algorithms of the internet reward those comments and the hits, and then you're driving that sort of dynamic. So we've got all sorts of actual incentives to not engage in reasonable debate, to not find balanced views, to not weigh up arguments that we might instinctively be a bit skeptical of, rather, you know, not immediately dismiss them. So we're being driven more and more in that direction, I think, and there's something that needs to be changed, and it's one of the things that I'm trying to contribute to in my book, but recognizing it's a much broader problem that we all need to tackle.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Tom. It's been really interesting and a pleasure.
Great, thank you ever so much.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.